All right. So when you guys hear the word trauma, what does that make you think of?
When I hear the word trauma, I think of like a bad experience somebody went through in their life as a little kid. And whenever they're in a certain situation in life, they're reminded of that bad incident that happened. And their emotions react as if that same situation was happening in the moment.
Hello and welcome to Just Talk, Educational Equity, the podcast about social justice and how it relates to everything education. I'm your host, Tony Neal.
And I'm today's co-host, Deborah Bowman. We are listening in on students from a public high school in the St. Louis area, Maplewood Richmond Heights School District, as they reflect on today's topic of trauma and triumph in school.
I think trauma is something anyone can go through at any time of their life, and it can cause triggers, or you can just live with it, and it could be underlying emotions that you have no clue about. There's a lot of different aspects to it.
Do you guys feel like in your lifetime you've had traumatic events happen?
Definitely.
And I'll say, when I was younger, about 8 years old, like living in the city, I hear gunshots a lot. So like now whenever I hear like people make loud noises, I say, oh, somebody's shooting. In the summertime, I work in this like inner city area, but it was somebody like in the trash, like in a dumpster throwing some away. It was like a huge bam on when you close the lid to the door. And I thought it was like a gunshot, but it wasn't. I just reacted as if it was a gunshot. I was like, what? Somebody's shooting. But really nobody was shooting. It was just somebody minding their own business throwing away trash.
Yeah.
So that's kind of an example for me.
So we can hear from these students' perceptions about trauma and their own experiences that this is something that lives on for all of us. And it might be something that we see as completely benign, but they're having another experience that comes up from their past that I think as educators we all need to be aware of. Before we go into our deep dive on this episode's topic of trauma and triumph in schools, what do you have for an icebreaker, Tony?
You know, we have just celebrated the life of a king, Dr. Martin Luther King, and there are a number of things that were taking place around town, and I'm just wondering, how have you maybe celebrated Dr. King's Day over your lifetime?
I like that question. I always try to make sure I'm spending some time on that day really reflecting on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and his true legacy as opposed to the sort of superficial, iconic treatment that we've had of him in popular media. I watched the documentary King in the Wilderness, rewatched it actually, to just really reflect on him and how his message and his sense of mission was actually growing and expanding as he went along in his life. And though he was such a young man, he just had this comprehensive understanding of American society, and he was not going to be limited by just one way of being. So in addition to his work in civil rights, he also expanded into working for peace and against the Vietnam War, and also, of course, his anti-poverty work was just starting to take off. How about you, Tony? What about you on Martin Luther King Jr. Day?
Well, I attended a program over at University of Missouri, St. Louis. It's their regular celebration that they have every year, and it was absolutely dynamic. They had a number of students that performed. Anita Jackson, who's known around town for her voice and doing solos, she sung a couple songs that were great. And Bree Newsom, she was the keynote speaker and knocked it out the park. She's the young woman that climbed the pole, I believe it is South Carolina.
Yeah, at Columbia, South
yes,
Carolina.
Yes, Columbia, South Carolina. Mm-hmm.
And took down the Confederate flag.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we listened to her for about an hour, and you could hear a pin drop in that auditorium. It was also a history lesson because she had a slideshow, and she talked about the history of racism, and she connected it to the slideshow that she was that we got a chance to see. So it was just a great way to come together to celebrate. A lot of singing. There were three students that received scholarships, and they read their essays that they wrote to receive the scholarship.
That sounds like it was a worthwhile use of time. You know, always coming together as community and recognizing the importance of the work and carrying on the work that Dr. King began. I know that's always on your heart. So it's right. Great you could do that.
Absolutely. And then having gone to Morehouse, as you know, Dr. King attended Morehouse. And so got a chance to really study about the King philosophy. And, you know, King was somewhat infused throughout the campus. And yes, so I feel a real close connection on King Day.
So let's get started on the deep dive for today's episode, which is dedicated to trauma-sensitive schools and teaching practices. We're calling this one Trauma and Triumph in Schools.
We're looking forward to our conversation with today's guest, who is an experienced and knowledgeable practitioner of trauma-informed teaching in schools, Travis Williams. Welcome to Just Talk.
Hi. Good to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. Travis, would you start off with a little bit about your background and how you came to thinking about trauma in education?
Sure. So I started off thinking I was just going to become a fairly traditional English teacher in high school, secondary ed, and noticed early on, even in my student teaching, that I really kind of gravitated towards a certain type of student that I was really kind of drawn to working with, and it was usually students that would now be more labeled at-risk and high-need students. And so my first teaching position out of college was at an alternative therapeutic high school and middle school. And basically, I spent 7 years there and learned a whole bunch about working with students from a very diverse range of backgrounds, and almost all of whom coming from areas that were just lots of traumatic life experiences and a lot of mental health issues and things like that, which kind of led me, the experience that I built up there as an English teacher in this therapeutic environment led me to coming into contact and working with the alternative programs at the school district I'm at now, which is the Maplewood-Richmond Heights School District. And so I came to MRH about 4 years ago, and we were just in the middle of kind of building out a couple of the programs that I work with now. One is an alternative to in-school suspension program that focuses on restorative practices, and the other is a full Tier 3 placement within the RTI framework that essentially identifies the most at-risk and high-need students in the district in the middle and high school level and allows them to kind of have a more therapeutic and supportive environment to hopefully meet some different and diverse needs and also respond to a lot of trauma and other challenging situations that vary across the spectrum with each individual.
So one of the things that as high school teachers, you know, we think of ourselves as subject area teachers, but it sounds like you've really evolved into addressing the needs of the student. And so I really want to hear more about that. When we talk about trauma and this concept of trauma-informed teaching in schools, what do we mean by that? And who is it that might experience trauma? How does that impact the learning process? Why is it important for us to pay attention to that?
So a lot of the research, especially in the last 5 to 10 years, that has come out related to stress and chronic stress, well, both acute and chronic stress, is really showing that there's a lot of changes to the brain that are affecting the way that students are able to learn and not learn and just kind of go about their daily life. And so with all of the students that I'm working with, you can point to specific things that have happened and or are continuing to go on in their daily life, whether it be that their families are struggling financially or they're in less than ideal environments or have been that way in the past that are really affecting the way that they're struggling to access their executive skills. And so a lot of the team that I work with in alternative programs focuses on this idea of, as practitioners, we need to be aware that our students may be having a hard time to access those executive skills and find better ways to help teach them to do something that we call zipping up, which is this idea of moving from working with our survival skills in the brainstem and moving through an emotional state in the limbic system and getting up to the from the back of the brain up to the front, which is why we call it zipping up, and which is where all of our executive functioning occurs. And so almost everything that we do has that in mind as ways to support that kind of fluidity within the way that students are working and thinking and developing these skills as we're working with them on, you know, academics as well.
You know, I'm wondering what type of support is given to families. You talk about working in the space of being in school, mm-hmm. And certainly that's where our students are. We want to meet their needs there. But we know that families play a large role in how students function. And so what support is given to the family to help with what you are mm-hmm. doing in the school system?
You know, district-wide, we do in-home visits with every student every year. Which I think is statistically shown to be one of the biggest game changers that schools can implement across the board is doing home visits, which is just a pretty profound way to establish contact and begin building relationships with families and also to kind of see where our students are coming from. And then when you come into kind of our interventionist role in alternative programs, that's really taken several much more intense steps further than that. So I've probably today had 5 or 6 text messages between different parents already today about, you know, everything from small trivial things to therapy appointments and other outside services. And we really wrap around our students as much as we can and are able to. With every family, it's different how much they want us to be involved and will let us. But for the students that I particularly work with, we have parent meetings on a much more frequent basis than you would in a traditional setting. And we partner with a lot of different organizations through the Children's, the CSF, the Children's Service Fund, I think. And so we have partnerships with organizations like Youth in Need and a few others, and including a counselor who has an office space in our building that meets with a lot of our students. So we have a lot of mental health services going on. We frequently work with behavioral health resource in times of crisis. So kind of that wraparound of trying to tap into as many services as possible with the families, not just to or at the families, and try to build good relationships with those parents. But it's hard. It's a challenge. It's a conversation that we're frequently talking about in terms of what is our sphere of influence? Where do we have to, you know, draw a line? You know, how many times can we drive over to a student's house and pick them up versus, you know, starting to recognize that we can carry someone so far, but at some point they have to start doing some of the walking as well and you know, recognizing where those boundaries are. But we definitely push those boundaries much further than a regular setting would.
It sounds like your district is leading the way in this area. Would you say that?
I would. Yeah, I would. That's one of the things I will tell anyone that listens is that I am profoundly impressed on a daily basis the amount of resources in terms of the human resources, the money, the support that the district is willing to put behind what is ultimately a pretty small percentage of the population.
So this is work that you're doing with students that you're really doing some intensive intervention work with them mm-hmm. And lots of support. So how about in other schools in the district and other ways in which they are addressing sort of trauma-sensitive mm-hmm. practices and school settings? What kind of work is going on around that in the district overall?
So that's really interesting question, and I really came to our district at a turning point that when I joined on to the alternative programs at MRH, we were a small team of alternative educators teaching about, 12 to 15 students out of a house next to the high school. And we had just begun to adopt a program called Conscious Discipline, which incorporates a lot of the brain state model that I was speaking to earlier. So alternative programs had developed their work with this program and really refined it and implemented it in a pretty, it was showing just really good results. And the rest of the district has, over the last couple of years, really begun to look at us as kind of an incubator for some of these practices. So now we spend the majority of our PD days working with other schools and practitioners in the district on developing a lot of the same structures and programs that we've been kind of honing and refining.
Yes. As educators, we're committed to learning and always learning to do better. So, and I know that district is really committed to do that. What are the key principles that this sort of practice is based on? What do people need to think about and be aware of and then respond mm-hmm. to? And how do they respond when they're thinking about trauma-sensitive practices?
So one of the things that one of my teaching partners, Melissa Foose, frequently likes to talk about when first introducing our evolution with this stuff is that when we're first exposed to conscious discipline and then later restorative practices and ultimately kind of realizing that all of this tied in with trauma-informed care was that the very first thing that some of the literature that we were reading at the time talked about was composure. And we were like, yes, our students definitely need a lot of help with composure. And they were like, no, it's composure with us.
Yes.
And that we needed to look inward first and kind of check ourselves.
You know, that's a basic principle of social justice, right, Tony?
Right. We often talk about stance. You know, mm-hmm. how do you show up? What does it mean just to show up with all the identities mm-hmm. of who you are? And so, you know, we talk about the heart before we can even move forward. You know, what does that mean?
Right. Just as students show up, a whole person in the mm-hmm. classroom, and we have to be cognizant and respectful of that, the same thing happens with educators. Yeah. We show up as a whole person. Who is that person that I'm bringing? Mm-hmm. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, so the really taking a step back and before we ever even began to look at what are we going to do to students, you
right.
know, is what are we going to do for ourselves? And then, you know, all of a sudden it stops being about looking at what, you know, anything to do with what are we going to do to students, but rather what are we going to do with students? You know, in restorative practices, they frequently refer to this kind of four-quadrant model called the social discipline window, and it talks about doing, you know, high control and high support is, you know, the upper right quadrant, and that's where you're doing stuff with students. And, you know, you can fall into any four of those quadrants or a spectrum of it at any time, and, you know, if you have lots of support, with little control, you end up really doing things for students. And if you have a lot of control with little support, then you're just doing things to students. And we really want to have high amounts of both and be doing things with our students. And we, you know, that ties in and kind of guides our thinking with everything that we're doing with students, hopefully on a day-to-day basis.
Nice, nice. Do you ever get any resistance, I guess, from the wider world as being kind of the white savior of, and you mentioned students at risk?
Yeah, so no is the short answer. Maplewood is a really interesting community. It's undergone just massive gentrification over the last, you know, 20 years and you can see the effects of that even from the difference in diversity from the older grades down to the younger grades. And it's something that I think is important as a white practitioner for me to be aware of and recognize that this isn't about me swooping in and showing, you know, a culture that may be different from my own at times the right way to do things, but rather coming in with a learning, you know, a willingness to learn and understand and just, you know, to be a support. And kind of recognizing that and recognizing and thinking about my own identity as I'm going into different homes and working with students from different populations and you know, I have students from just such a broad spectrum of backgrounds and it's one of those things that I really value and just try to keep as much respect towards as possible. But
so you're talking a lot about doing this in high school mm-hmm. and helping students learn about zipping up. What does that look like? What kind of work are you doing? What are the strategies that you have in place that you're employing?
That's a great question. Because that really digs into like the meat of a lot of our work and the way that integrates into even our, you know, academic instruction. There's so much that I couldn't begin to cover everything that we do moment to moment to support that. But
it's a limited podcast, yeah. and I know that.
We have to have you back for part two.
Yeah, I want to give a few examples, though.
Good,
so
good.
One small thing is that in each of our spaces, as students arrive, there is a very explicit and deliberate attempt to make physical contact with every student that comes in. And so if you watch the Student Success Center, which is the house that houses our alternative programs, you'll see Mr. Pot out there, no matter what the weather is, every day, welcoming every student, giving, you know, classic Harry Wong style, giving them a fist bump as they come in. And so we're immediately trying to make connections with students. If you walk into my classroom at 5 minutes past bell every day, you'll see everyone sitting around doing our 5 minutes of mindfulness. And so we're immediately, you know, doing things to support students being able to calm down and get to a place where they feel connected with us and safe within the space. And so we have little daily rituals like that, a lot of rituals that hopefully create more of a family environment. We constantly refer to our communities as school families, and we really do try to treat it that way. Every Thanksgiving, we have big, you know, Thanksgiving meals. We don't do pizza parties as like rewards and things like that, but rather we really look at anything that would normally look like that is a celebration. And so whether someone has succeeded or not, they're not going to be excluded because we wouldn't do that with our own family. And so we really try to create a climate of safety and love and connection with everyone. In every learning space, you will find some spot that is labeled or known by the students as a chill zone or a safe space. And we explicitly teach students that this is a space that we will never tell them to go to. We make that commitment, you know, very straightforward to them, but that they can go to and at any time that they need to and practice a myriad of coping skills and de-escalation techniques that we've spent time teaching them. And they can be there as long as they need to. And we really look at every behavior as some form of communication. And so to do something like that, to have a safe space in our classroom that we relinquish all power and control over, can be a pretty scary thing for a teacher. You know, the first question I always get is, well, what if they just go there and sit there and avoid work all day?
Yeah.
It's like, well, they're telling you something by that. And that is, that's great because now you're learning something that you know what your next step to be is to, you know, start talking and develop a dialogue about that, to start, you know, building and continuing a relationship with that student to figure out how to help them.
Well, right. If a student is choosing that and they are learning something.
Right.
And there are other ways students tell us, I'm not ready to engage with whatever the subject matter is you're trying to address to me today. And often those things are, you know, difficult for a teacher to take in and read it in that way, and it creates problems for a teacher and other learners in the classroom, whereas this is a way that someone can access themselves and say, okay, what do I need to do to get to where I could move on in learning in other ways?
Oftentimes we'll have students referred to us, and the reports that we'll be getting from their former teachers and administrators will include, you know, examples and anecdotes of lots of, you know, behaviors that we frequently have a hard time even seeing in our spaces.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And what we're recognizing is that just by, like, starting with a different approach to the way that we, you know, the climate and culture comes first, 'cause if you don't feel safe and you don't feel connected to the people in your space, it's going to be really hard to learn. And so we have to do those things before we can start expecting students to you know, do heavy cognitive processing and learn stuff. So.
We like to include a segment suggesting helpful resources for educators at this point. Travis, what do you suggest for listeners who want to explore the topic of trauma-sensitive education in greater depth?
So I can definitely recommend any of the literature from Conscious Discipline, which I'll just say I've never been a big fan of, like, prepackaged educational and behavioral programs and things like that. And so whenever I'm telling people about Conscious Discipline, I strongly encourage them to look past the branding and really look at both the how heavily research-based it is and the specific content and practices. Furthermore, you know, we focus with our work with high schoolers and middle schoolers, and it's geared much more towards early childhood. We're one of the first programs to really take a lot of that material and modify and adapt it for older kids, and it is profound in how successful that's been. So the author of both of the Conscious Discipline books, her name is Becky Bailey. I can also recommend something more specific to more of these ideas related to trauma and how that affects students, and some of the research done in a lot of schools across the country is a book called Teaching with Poverty in Mind. And that's by Eric Jensen. I've read that and thoroughly enjoyed that and saw it complementing a lot of the practices and things that I'd learned through Conscious Discipline. And then within the restorative practices field, there's a lot of good literature out there. There's an organization called the International Institute for Restorative Practices, the IIRP, that has a number of good publications out there, including the Restorative Practices Handbook, which I think has a lot of really clear-cut, straightforward structures and practices that anyone from teachers to counselors to administrators can really start to incorporate into their work.
Great. Great. Well, I think that about wraps it up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Travis Williams of Maplewood Richmond Heights High School for being our studio guest today. We appreciate your insights on the topic of trauma-sensitive practices in education. And we're looking forward to our next episode to hearing from your students. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Great. Can you give us a little preview on the kind of things that we may hear or... they may share with us, is that going to be a surprise?
Both of our English teachers in alternative programs are working with a book with several students right now that actually incorporates this idea of students being given a free space to kind of just talk and communicate with each other and share ideas. And I can't remember the name of the book right now, but... essentially, every Friday, the students in this book get 30 minutes or an hour at the end of their week to talk without any adults present. And so when we were approached by you all with the idea of gathering some of our students' thoughts about what it's like to be in our spaces and in our program, we thought, well, we'll just replicate what they're about to start reading in their books. So we're going to take the microphones that you gave us.
Excellent.
And give them a few questions and just let them run with it. So
okay, good.
Who knows what they'll bring you?
Well, we're looking forward to hearing from them.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Thank you, Travis.
This has been Tony Neal, your host.
And Deborah Bowman, today's co-host and podcast producer and director.
Bringing you Just Talk, Educational Equity.
Another shout out to Travis Williams, today's studio guest, as we looked at the topic of trauma and triumph. We are looking forward to our next episode when we hear from Travis's students about their reflections on this topic.
Listeners, we appreciate that you joined us for this episode, and we invite you to share your comments, questions, and suggestions on our website at EEC4Justice, and leave us an email there on our contact page. We're looking for student writing on social justice topics to include in each episode. So contact us at the website if you have an interest in contributing.
Also, and this is important, if you enjoyed today's podcast, please find us on iTunes and leave us a rating. You can help other people find us that way, and we appreciate your support.
Just Talk has been brought to you by Educational Equity Consultants, a company that provides training to build the capacity of individuals, schools, and other organizations to address racism in ways that enable all people to reclaim their inherent intelligence and nobility.
So if you're a teacher or school leader, a student, a parent, or a community member concerned about social justice, please remember,
Just Talk.